Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. President Bush will be facing a tough crowd when he delivers his State of the Union speech to the nation tonight. A new Wall Street Journal NBC poll shows the president's approval ratings down about 10 points from last year. 39% of respondents believe the president is doing a good job. 54% say he isn't. But the president will also be going into tonight's speech with a victory under his belt. This morning, the Senate confirmed Samuel Alito as the 110th Supreme Court Justice. The vote, 58-40. Well, what might we expect tonight? Joining us first, Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. And Julie, first of all, how will the confirmation of Samuel Alito help bolster the president's message?
Well, hi, Robin. It'll give him something nice to talk about and a solid accomplishment, which has really been lacking this past year. He hasn't had many successes in Congress, so that'll give him something to talk about.
Right. And the war in Iraq in particular, a lot of controversy, likely to be a big part of his speech. What is he expected to say to sway Americans, you know?
It's going to be fascinating to hear what he has to say, because obviously he has to give a positive, upbeat, hopeful message about Iraq, but here we have the extremely high-profile wounding of Bob Woodruff from ABC and his cameraman, and that's very much on people's minds. So I believe he'll give an acknowledgement of these kinds of losses and these kinds of damage, and then go on to say, well, the important thing is we have to stay the course.
The president is expected to push alternative energy sources today. Now, we're going to be speaking later about ExxonMobil's huge record profits. Some say making this company richer than most oil-producing nations. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing the president then can talk about giving tax breaks to companies to develop alternatives.
Sure. Alternative. One of the alternatives he talks about quite a bit that we might hear about tonight is nuclear power, or nuclear power, as the president calls it. But that's something that's very high on his agenda, and I think he's definitely going to be pushing for an easing of regulations to allow the development of more nuclear power plants.
But not to the oil, not an easing on the oil industry, not in light of...
Not overtly. They like to, they've been stuck with that label so hard as being the administration of being such good friends of the oil industry that they like to tread very quietly around that. They don't trumpet those relationships.
Well, last year's bid to change Social Security failed. Do you think we're going to see any big reform issues come out of tonight's speech?
No, I don't. Modest, little, small proposals that are going to go not very far. Health savings accounts, I don't think there'll be a groundswell. Part of the problem, Robin, is he doesn't have any money to do any big new initiatives or big new programs. He has to bring moderates back in to his support base, and so it's going to be little feel-good things. He might even propose some mining reform.
Well, we will listen for that. And, of course, after the news, the headlines in the U.S. about what's happened to minors, that will come as good news to people. Julie Mason covers the White House for the Houston Chronicle, speaking to us from her office in Washington. Julie, thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, 2006 is shaping up to be a key midterm election year for Congress, making the president's message tonight more important than ever to candidates. Democrats have hopes of reclaiming one or both houses of Congress. And tonight we touch down in two states. We'll be talking to a Republican operative in a moment. But first we go to Iowa, where there's a crowded primary race in the first congressional district. Jeff Link is working on the campaign of Democrat Bruce Braley. And Jeff joins us now on the line from Des Moines. Jeff, it does look like Iowa is shaping up to be an important state this year.
Yes, we have a lot of important races. I think important races not just for Iowa but for the country. In the first district, Democrats have one of the great pickup opportunities where we can turn a Republican seat into a Democratic seat, and we're trying to hold our governor's mansion with Tom Vilsack leaving office. It'll be tough to hang on to it, but we feel strongly that we can.
And Tom Vilsack, of course, may be making a run for president. But what, in your view, is the main concern for people there? What does President Bush need to say in his State of the Union address to deal with their concerns?
Well, I think first and foremost, the president has to give us a plan on Iraq. We need to have a plan for what we're going to do, when we're going to leave, when we can start bringing troops home. I think that's first and foremost on the minds of people here in Iowa.
Well, you say Iraq, but I know you've also been on the campaign trail in this crowded primary there.
Mm-hmm.
What are people saying? Again, they're going to be Democrats that you're coming across, but what are they saying?
Jobs and health care. People want to know, how do they attain any sort of economic security in this economy and with the prospect of one big health event in their life bankrupting them?
Well, the president is expected to present some proposals tonight, including health savings accounts. They allow people to set aside tax-free dollars to cover medical expenses. Your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, it's good for people who pay taxes to have those tax breaks, but a lot of the uninsured in America don't pay federal income taxes. They don't make enough money to pay federal income taxes, and it really leaves them in the lurch. And as a small business person who just switched to a health savings account, I can tell you they are not a panacea. They don't work the way they're supposed to at this point.
Why not? What problem do you have?
Doctor's offices still can't take payments from these health savings accounts. They don't know how to deal with them because they're different than the usual deductibles, and a lot of your bills that you submit get sent back from the insurance company. So it's just a hassle all the way around.
What about President Bush's message on the economy?
Jobs are a huge problem in Iowa, largely because one of our iconic manufacturers, Maytag, which makes washing machine and dryers, is about to be purchased by Whirlpool, and there's a lot of concern that those jobs are going to either disappear overseas or disappear out of Iowa. The president needs to make a strong statement about trade, about having fair trade that benefits manufacturers here in the United States. We have a huge trade imbalance, which this president has really not dealt with, and that would go a long way towards addressing some of these concerns.
Well, we know that the president is expected to talk about alternative energy sources in his speech tonight, ethanol being one, and I'm sure that's going to please people in your area.
Yeah, ethanol is very important to our economy. It adds value to our agriculture products by producing ethanol here, and we hope that the president does more and puts real teeth into a renewable energy policy for this country.
Jeff Link, Democratic strategist in Iowa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we turn now to John Brabender, a political strategist who works on Republican campaigns across the country, including Senator Rick Santorum's race in Pennsylvania. Welcome, John.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And you're a strategist, so first off, what would you tell the president to talk about tonight, the one thing?
Well, I think if there's one thing he needs to accomplish, it's for people who tune in to sort of feel better about themselves and better about America after listening to them. I think that as a country, we're looking for some hope right now, and I think the president needs to provide that type of hope in this speech.
Give me one example.
Well, energy is a great example in that if you remember in the 1960s, President Kennedy at the time sort of pulled us all together by saying, you know what, we're going to meet the challenge of going to the moon. And it was something we could all get behind. It had tangible results. I think we're at the same point relative to energy right now. I think the president has to stand up and say, we need to be less dependent on foreign oil. We have to challenge ourselves as Americans to find an alternative fuel source, energy source.
Well, but this is a pickup-driving former oil man. Yeah, do you think your people in Pennsylvania there are going to buy that message?
Well, I think they are. In Pennsylvania, for example, we're seeing that there's a new technology coming to Pennsylvania. It'll be the first coal-to-gas plant in America, where coal obviously is in abundance in Pennsylvania and an important part of our industry. I think that people do understand that foreign oil causes us a terrorist problem and a global problem.
Well, I was going to ask you, what do you think people want to hear from the president on the issue of Iraq? Let's start there.
Well, I think they want to understand, again, the purpose of the mission and hear from the president again how important this is. I think when we get into an argument over the tactics or we get into a discussion of just what is going right or wrong, that honestly doesn't work to the president's benefit. I think he has to shape this as a larger referendum or a larger message about this truly is a fight to protect family. This truly is a fight against terrorism and those who want to harm America. And I think when people see it in that context, that it favors the president's position.
You started off by saying that people want to know if their families are safe. And that brings us to another, what some people think is a problem for the president, the domestic spying program. What does he have to say to your voters?
I think he has to explain to them that this ultimately comes down to nothing more than keeping their family safe.
Well, and the Bush administration has put the war in Iraq and the war on terrorism into the context of spreading democracy around the world. But as you know, last week we saw the terrorist organization Hamas win the Palestinian parliamentary elections. Do you think that message of spreading democracy will backfire if he uses it again tonight?
Well, I think it's more than just spreading democracy, though. I think the president has been clear that you can't have democracy completely if you have states or organizations that also believe in terrorist acts and harming others as part of their process.
John Brabender, a political strategist who works on Republican campaigns. And, John, we just heard from Jeff Link, a Democratic strategist, who said that health care is one of the most important issues to people in Iowa, where he's working. What are people telling you that they want out of their health care?
Well, a number of things. One is they want portability so that, you know, as they go from place to place that their health care comes with them. We also see a lot of small business owners who say that, you know, health care is just killing my business and I have to find a better way to make this more affordable. And I think the president will probably talk about association health plans tonight as a way to do that. I also think the other thing is long-term care is a problem that we're going to have to start addressing. I don't know if the president will address it tonight, but, you know, with science allowing us to live longer, it also creates certain economic burdens on families that has to start being addressed. So I think you'll hear a little bit about that either today or in the future. And certainly health care savings accounts, I think the president is likely to talk about tonight, which makes health care more affordable for more families.
That's John Brabender, a political strategist working on Republican campaigns, including Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum's reelection campaign. John, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, history often proves to be the harshest critic of any State of the Union address. This week, USA Today looked back at last year's speech and reviewed 10 key proposals. First up, Social Security reform. Here's what the president said last year.
As we fix Social Security, we also have the responsibility to make the system a better deal for younger workers. And the best way to reach that goal is through voluntary personal retirement accounts.
The president then spent a great deal of his political capital on his idea to create personal retirement accounts, but the idea lacked popular support and Congress let it die. Next up, immigration reform.
It is time for an immigration policy that permits temporary guest workers to fill jobs Americans will not take, that rejects amnesty, that tells us who is entering and leaving our country, and that closes the border to drug dealers and terrorists.
This issue was also heavily hyped, but so far there is no guest worker program, though the Associated Press reports a bill is set to be submitted in February. The president had more luck on energy issues.
And my budget provides strong funding for leading-edge technology, from hydrogen-fueled cars to clean coal to renewable sources such as ethanol.
Congress ended up approving billions of dollars in tax subsidies to energy companies. The law also promoted alternative energy sources. Lawmakers also agreed with the president on tort reform and passed a bill to send many class action lawsuits to federal court, where they're more difficult to win. So the final count, out of 10 of President Bush's proposals in last year's State of the Union, USA Today found that 2 measures passed, 5 failed, and 3 had mixed results. Well, just ahead, we'll have more on those tax breaks that the president suggested and Congress delivered to energy companies last year. Those companies now are making record profits. ExxonMobil, as we said, richer now than many oil-producing companies. So why are we paying so much at the pumps? Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Here and now. At a time when consumers are paying more at the pump, ExxonMobil announced earnings of $36 billion last year, more than $10 billion in just the last quarter. That's the largest quarterly profit of any company in history. To put that figure into numbers we can understand, that amounts to about $80,842 per minute in profit during the fourth quarter. And that math, by the way, courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. Well, to talk about how companies are able to make this money and whether they will be allowed to continue, we're joined now by Philip Verlinger, senior fellow at the Institute for International Economics. He also worked in the Carter administration and was one of the authors of the windfall profit tax that was passed during the energy crisis in the 1970s. He joins us from his home in Aspen, Colorado. Phil, thank you.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And we're noticing that Exxon isn't exactly trumpeting these profits. In fact, Exxon took out ads in the run-up to this report, seeming to try to deflect the report.
I saw the ads, and Exxon is actually justified in deflecting them. I'm not a defender of the oil industry. I'm an economist. But The profits are the results of a series of decisions that have been made over the last 7 or 8 years, a lot of them originating in government, that have essentially created the conditions in which the profits are made.
Well, let's take a look at some of those. You know, are you saying that the companies aren't as much to blame as, say, Washington? How would Washington figure into this?
Well, in the late 90s, we had a series of mergers. BP bought Amoco, Exxon bought Mobil. And in each of these mergers, the Federal Trade Commission reviewed the situation, and several required that refineries be sold. Now, at the time, I and a couple of other economists kept saying that this was a mistake, because the companies that bought the refineries, Tesoro and Valero are the names, were small refineries which could not fund refinery expansions. We need more gasoline, and essentially we haven't built refining capacity to make more gasoline. And what I kept suggesting was that the FTC require, as a condition of the merger, for ExxonMobil, for Shell and Texaco and others, to build more, to expand their refining capacity. So we lost an opportunity to expand capacity.
So let's hold you up there, Phil Verlinger, to just a review.
Right.
So you're saying that as part of these mergers, they were required to, you know, sort of spread some of the love around, if you will, and give some of the refinery business to these small refineries.
Right.
But the end result is that the small refineries haven't been able to keep up with production and demand, and that's leading to higher prices?
Precisely. We don't have enough supply. The second element is that we have been requiring fuels to be cleaner, which we should, remove sulfur. And the refiners told the government that they'd make the investments to make the cleaner fuels. The alternative would have been for Detroit to spend more money on every new car so that you didn't need quite such clean fuels, but you cut the emissions. But that the refiners, particularly, again, these smaller refiners, didn't have the money both to expand capacity, which we needed for more supply, which would have kept prices down, and make the environmental investments. So they made the environmental investments. Then the third element is that we failed to push fuel economy. When the President Bush first introduced his energy bill in 2001, there was no call for improved fuel economy. We didn't see any calls for fuel economy. Attempts to push fuel economy have been defeated, and so Detroit kept selling us these bigger and bigger cars and these SUVs, and push demand up. So it's a combination of circumstances, and they're real, and so there's plenty of blame to go around.
Well, there is, but I want to bring it back to the companies for a second, because
sure.
We know the car companies
right.
have been punished, in fact, for their decision making. But you know, couldn't oil companies have lowered prices, given that they saw way in advance these huge profits? I mean, it would seem simple to the average consumer.
Sure, they could have lowered prices at the wholesale level, but the problem is, they wouldn't have been passed through, because essentially this is the gasoline market and the heating oil market are very competitive markets, and the profit would have gone someplace else. The price of gasoline is set on some relatively competitive markets in California, Houston, and New York, and given the amount of gasoline they make and the amount of heating oil they can make, there was no way to bring the prices down. We're at capacity.
Well, politically, it would seem that Republican lawmakers are particularly squeezed by this. The White House, we understand, is pressuring them to kill a proposed tax on oil companies. And as we mentioned, the energy bill slipped in tax breaks for oil companies. And it doesn't seem as if that's very defensible now in light of Exxon's profits. But I want to ask you what you think the fix is now with a couple minutes we have left. Congress is also talking about a windfall profit tax. You were one of the authors, as we said, of the windfall profit tax back in the 70s. As succinctly as you can, do you think something like that is needed now?
The windfall profit tax then captured some windfalls. These aren't windfalls. What is needed now, I'm afraid, is a major gasoline tax. Your previous speaker spoke of the risk from the Middle East, and I agree. And we have to convince the world that we're not a paper tiger. We need to cut consumption. What I've been pushing is a gasoline tax, large gasoline tax that would take effect in a couple of years, combined with a massive federal program to buy back SUVs that Americans voluntarily sold.
But, Phil, you know, people I can hear saying, well, wait a minute, you know, that puts the blame on the consumer. But I'm wondering if you're saying if by weaning the consumers off of spending a lot on gas, if they're taxed for it, they might spend less, find other forms of travel, they might take these profits as an end result away from the oil companies.
That's exactly what I'm saying. The profits would go down, the price of oil would go down. There are, you know, a lot of automakers make in Europe cars that get twice the fuel economy in the same body as they sell over here. So Mercedes will get 40 over there, 20 miles per gallon over here. It is perfectly possible to get consumption down, and I want to be generous. I think consumers didn't know the prices were going to rise like this, and I want to offer them a price that holds that protects them from the losses they've taken on their SUVs. But I just want to get all these SUVs and these heavy cars off so I can show the Iranians and the Venezuelans and so on that the United States really does understand about fuel economy. And I think we should use a lot more ethanol, as the spokesman from Iowa said.
Yeah.
It all would work out.
Phil Verliger, Senior Fellow with the Institute for International Economics, with some intriguing ideas about energy savings. And we look forward to the President's speech to see if he's listening to you. Phil, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. And I look forward to the speech and hearing you again.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes now. In Atlanta, flags at the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change are flying at half-staff today in memory of King's widow, Coretta Scott King, who died overnight at 78. Coretta Scott King will be remembered for continuing the nonviolent legacy of her husband after his 1968 assassination. Here she is speaking at Ebenezer Baptist Church on January 20, 2004.
We must always respect the dignity and humanity of our adversaries. As Martin said, if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition.
Growing up in segregated Alabama during the Depression, young Coretta helped her family by picking cotton. She worked her way through college, studied voice and violin in the 1950s here in Boston, where she met her future husband. She wore a blue gown on her wedding day and refused to say obey in her vows. Joining us now on the line from Atlanta is Juanita Abernathy, wife of the late Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who helped lead the Southern Christian Leadership Council with Martin Luther King. Juanita, you knew Mrs. King well. What was she like?
I would say that she was strong, determined. She was a fighter, a great American, and a rock. I guess those are the words, the adjectives that will best describe her.
I understand Coretta Scott King was an activist before she met her husband. At first, she wasn't all that impressed with him.
Yes, and we grew up in Alabama, mm-hmm. in the same county.
And so you had a lot of in common in that you both married activists, became activists alongside them. How hard was that for Coretta Scott King, you know, to proudly march by her husband? But, you know, there were trials at times. How hard was that?
Well, it was very difficult, but when you are strong and you know what you're doing is right, it doesn't become a burden. Instead, it's a pleasure. And those were difficult times. Hmm. However, we knew that the cause was just. And when you know you're right and that God is on your side, you're fearless. Hmm.
She seemed so placid at times that were so turbulent. We remember her reading the march just days after her husband was gunned down with that sort of, much as Jacqueline Kennedy did, sort of that placid, determined look on her face. We understand on their first date together, Reverend King said to Coretta Scott, "You have everything I ever wanted in a woman. We ought to get married someday." What did she have? What do you think she had?
I think it was a strength that he saw. I always say ministers' wives are special individuals, and he knew that as a minister, he had to have a special kind of woman to be at his side. Mm. See, our homes were bombed, and our churches were bombed. They bombed my house the same night they bombed my church. Mm. And they bombed Dr. King's house.
Juanita Abernathy, what do you think the legacy of Coretta King will be?
I think her legacy will be that of perpetuating nonviolence through direct action and through keeping the dream of her husband alive and trying to make America America for everybody.
Juanita Abernathy, wife of the late civil rights leader Ralph Abernathy, remembering Coretta Scott King, who died overnight at 78. When Federal Reserve Board Chair Alan Greenspan steps down today, artist Erin Crowe loses her muse. Crowe's exhibit of her Greenspan portraits, Goodbye Greenspan, just opened at the prestigious Broom Gallery in New York City. You can see them, by the way, at here-now.org. And Erin, I see Greenspan with a lot of folds in his face. How do you describe your portraits of him?
I would say that they are very expressionistic in their use of colors. And he does have a lot of folds and wrinkles in his face.
Which is wonderful for an artist.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, and especially certain expressions, like when he raises his eyebrows really high, he gets lots of intricate detail that it's fun to make out of paint.
Well, tell us some of the titles of the pictures.
Some of them have to do with what he's doing in the picture. There's one where he has his glasses off. He's just getting ready to blow on them, and that one's called which is lots of H's. There's one that's called What'd You Say? It looks like, you know, someone said something, and he's just averting his eyes over towards them.
Yeah. Which one is called Doe, like Homer Simpson's comment?
Oh, that's one where he has his hand on his forehead. He looks upset about something.
Well, how did you start doing this? Why Alan Greenspan?
I did a fellowship through the University of Virginia, and I had a year where I could paint anything I wanted. I didn't know what I wanted to paint. You know, once I started painting Alan Greenspan, I really couldn't stop. I was so excited by, you know, his face, and I was really excited about the opportunity to sell the work.
Well, I was going to say, the excitement must have grown as you took the paintings to Sag Harbor on Long Island, where many of the big money people from Wall Street vacation, and sold them for thousands of dollars. Were you shocked?
Well, I mean, I guess I had always hoped that that would happen, but I was definitely surprised when the entire show sold out.
Are you able to do what you set out to do, which is pay for some grad school?
Yeah, no, I've paid for my tuition for my first year, and I'm in my first year of graduate school now, and with this show I hope to pay for next year.
Have you asked him to come to your showing?
I have. I sent him an invitation, and I wrote him a letter at one point trying to explain, you know, why I had painted him so many times and that I wasn't a complete weirdo or anything like that.
Erin, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
That's artist and Greenspan portraitist Erin Crowe. So, what does Mrs. Alan Greenspan think about the paintings? Andrea Mitchell, chief foreign correspondent for NBC News, joins us now. Andrea, you've seen the paintings. What do you think?
I think they're great. I think it's charming. And what especially pleases me is that apparently her success last summer with her initial paintings helped her pay for graduate school. So that's wonderful.
You know, I wonder how you feel on this day about the many different tributes coming in for your husband. There's been a symphony written for him. We see these paintings. Why do you think he's so captured people's imagination?
Well, I'd like to think because he really has focused on the fundamentals, on trying to help people's standard of living increase and expand the economy. You know, there are ups and downs, obviously, but over 18 years, it's definitely gone up. And now I'm obviously a biased observer, but I think he really represents the best of public service. Whether you like him or don't like him or disagree or agree, he really cares about, you know, doing the right thing.
He is beloved, and as you mentioned, he has critics as well, and there are those who say he was in charge when there were some big imbalances in the economy, you know, in consumer debt or in the housing market. And I wonder, as he leaves, does, you know, is there something he feels he could have done better? Is there something that's nagging at him? Or, you know, what's his sense of his legacy?
I think his legacy would be the fundamentals that the Fed is, by law, obliged to focus on, and that is to control inflation and keep economic growth moving upward on a sustainable basis. But he will write his own version of what he's learned over these years and his sort of bigger thoughts on how the world works, and he'll be able to speak unfettered, which will be the first time in nearly two decades that he can give his own opinions.
Yes, but will we understand him?
You will. Believe me, the man speaks English. It's only when he's testifying to Congress or making very carefully modulated speeches where he has to worry about the impact of his statements on markets, but that will no longer be the case as of midnight tonight.
That's Andrea Mitchell of NBC News speaking about her husband, Alan Greenspan, retiring today as chair of the Federal Reserve. And this reminder still ahead, Jeff Tweedy of the rock band Wilco. You're listening to Here and Now.
The films selected as the Best Picture nominees for 2005 are Brokeback Mountain, Diana Ossana and James Shamus, producers.
This morning, nominations for the Academy Awards were announced in Los Angeles. Brokeback Mountain led the way with 8 nominations, including Best Picture and Best Actor for Heath Ledger, who plays one half of the film's star-crossed gay couple. Other Best Actor nominees were Philip Seymour Hoffman for Capote, Terrence Howard for Hustle and Flow, Joaquin Phoenix for Walk the Line, and David Strathairn for Good Night and Good Luck. The women receiving Best Actress nods were Judi Dench for Mrs. Henderson Presents, Felicity Huffman for Transamerica, Keira Knightley for Pride and Prejudice, Charlize Theron for North Country, and Reese Witherspoon for Walk the Line. Well, among those waiting for the nominations this morning, rolling pins in hand, were the cookie makers at Elena's Bakery in New York City. Every year, Elena's makes special Oscar cookies featuring edible likenesses of the best actor and actresses, as well as cookies paying tribute to the films up for Best Picture. So joining us on the line from New York is bakery owner Eleni Giannopoulos. And Eleni, how do you make these edible images? Do you have the pictures right there ready?
We have an artist that we've worked with for the past few years who's wonderful, and we did make some predictions of our own prior to the announcement today, and I'm happy to say that the actor and actresses that we picked in advance were all chosen.
So really?
We have, yes, which we were thrilled.
Did you pick Terrence Howard? He was the pimp in Hustle and Flow, because that was a bit of a surprise for people. Entertainment Weekly thought it would be Russell Crowe for Cinderella Man.
I did not pick Terrence Howard.
Okay. All right.
Because we tried to pick some in advance so that we're as prepared as possible. We certainly went with Philip Seymour Hoffman, Heath Ledger, and Joaquin Phoenix. We went with Reese, and we were so thrilled that Charlie was nominated. Charlize was nominated again this year because we have a beautiful drawing from her from last year, which we're excited to bring to our collection.
This is Charlize Theron of North Country fame. She was nominated as an actress in a leading role. You know, I'm wondering, a few years ago, many Oscar watchers were shocked when 13-year-old Keisha Castle Hughes was nominated for Best Actress for Whale Rider because they thought it was going to be Nicole Kidman for Cold Mountain. Did you have to take a lot of Nicole Kidman cookies out of the oven?
Yes, that's exactly what happened to us. We had predicted Nicole Kidman and were, I guess, along with other people, shocked to see that she was not nominated.
Yeah. Well, we know that you do the films as well. How are you going to, for instance, telegraph, Brokeback Mountain?
With Brokeback sweeping the nominations, we're going to do horses and cowboy hats, cowboy boots, some little director slates, and really portray that movie.
Will you do anything to signal, you know, the theme of the movie, that these were cowboys in love? Will you...
I mean, maybe it's that some of the cookies will be baked together in the oven, suggesting that they are joined.
Well, there you go. Well, how are you going to do Crash, which was the huge ensemble film about racism and car crashes and how different people intersected?
I know, that's a little bit of a twist. I think we're going to use some car cookie cutters or have some custom made for us, maybe with a little bit of a angle on the front implying that the car has been crashed.
But, and what about Munich, a very serious film about Israel's response to the slaughter of their Olympic athletes? It's directed by Steven Spielberg, who also got a director nod. I mean, that's a pretty serious topic.
Very serious. I think with Munich, we're going to address it with the Olympic rings, which will be, I think, very serious and very appropriate.
Yep. Yep.
With Good Night, Good Luck, we're going to, I think, use a television.
Ah.
And with Capote, we're very excited to introduce the glasses, which I think are so recognizable, and also a book.
Ah, Capote's glasses over a book. Because, again, that was another serious topic, and it's tough to make that one into a cookie either, but you've done it.
It will be fun to have a wide assortment, and, you know, it really makes a person's Oscar party dessert really kind of unique.
Eleni Giannopoulos, the owner of Eleni's Bakery in New York City, which bakes Oscar nominee cookies every year, so they're having a busy day. Eleni, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, actress and Oscar nominee Charlize Theron was previously immortalized on Eleni's Cookies 2 years ago when she won the Oscar for her role as a serial killer in Monster. That, of course, would have been a cookie monster. Sorry. We leave you with Joaquin Phoenix as Johnny Cash in Walk the Line, another nominee. Stay with us. More ahead here now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
in your neighborhood. The sugar rush tastes so good, just so misunderstood. You're so misunderstood.
And that's the song Misunderstood from Wilco's latest CD. And despite the song title, this is a band that seems to have no trouble getting its message across. Without much radio play, and at one point without even a record label, the Chicago-based group has carved out a critically acclaimed 10-year career that includes a Grammy Award. Wilco's leader is Jeff Tweedy. He's starting a solo tour tonight in Vancouver, but he recently joined us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. The new Wilco CD is a live recording called Kicking Television. And on it, you can hear the connection between the band and its fans. They know the words. They sing along to the songs. So I asked Jeff Tweedy whether he really feels misunderstood.
I really have no idea if we're understood or not. I don't think it's really our job to know. But certainly the people that come see us play understand something about what they're there for, and I think it's to have a good time in spite of all of the negativity and the lyrics and the music.
We should give some context, too. Wilco is a band that was dropped by its label after the label felt an album wasn't commercial enough. You relaunched the album on the internet. It was so successful that the label had to buy the record back for more than they originally offered you.
A different label, but owned by the same parent company.
Right.
Yes.
So real nya-nya there. And I don't know, it seems to telegraph how important the fan base is to Wilco.
What Wilco has done over the years more than anything is tour and play live shows. And it's pretty much how we've maintained our livelihoods is through our performances. And being so persistent over the years, a hardcore following of fans has kind of developed and grown up around the band. There's a community of people that seem to be involved in the band on the internet and at our shows and follow us around and do a lot of that. So, yeah, I don't know. Over the years, it's worked out that there's been a lot of goodwill between us and our audience.
Especially, as you said, on the internet. And I want to ask you about that, because in some ways that sets you apart from other artists on the issue of downloading and free music. Wilco puts bonus songs on the net. Now, you were asked by Wired Magazine about how you felt about this, and I'm paraphrasing here, but you said a court decision to ban music sampling that's not licensed is sort of like racism.
Well, that was a little inflammatory, probably. I think it totally flies in the face of what music is for, and as a band, we've always tried to be heard, and the internet is just another way for our band to be heard.
Let's talk about what people are listening to, both on the internet and on this new CD in particular. I just want to ask, we heard a little of the song Misunderstood. For those who are not familiar with Wilco, and there's one or two, we just don't want to give the wrong impression about the sound of the band, because it rocks. In this song in particular, it just busts open, and there seems to be a little bit of not a new guitar sound, but a bigger guitar sound. Let's listen.
I think ultimately we've always considered ourselves a rock band, and that's part of the joy of being in a rock band is being loud.
Our guess is that you've shaken off that alternative country label.
No, surprisingly not. I keep thinking with each record that it might go away, but then ultimately I see reviews that use that phrase a lot. It doesn't really bother me anymore. It's just, it is what it is.
What is it to you? How would you categorize Wilco?
Oh, I think it's just fine with me just to be a rock band. I know that people don't really know what that means anymore, but that was kind of the beauty of it in the past to me, was that rock music was this giant umbrella for all kinds of different things. There were elements of country music, elements of soul music. It was all kind of about a feeling and a spirit and an attitude towards life. And for me, I think just being a rock band is all I really have ever aspired to be. So that's what I would use.
Well, in fact, let's listen to a little more from CD that sort of borrows its title anyway from another genre. Let's listen to Heavy Metal Drummer.
I've been to those heavy metal bands. They used to go see on the rally.
Jeff Tweedy, we have something we have to ask you because we're concerned. We heard an interview you did with Minnesota Public Radio where you said you feel like you're playing on borrowed time. And then Wired Magazine called you the haunted Jeff Tweedy.
I'm sitting here across from my wife and she's rolling her eyes at me. She like continues, you know, keeps rolling her eyes about the ghost part or the haunted part. But the borrowed time part, I think, you know, as a band, we talk about it all the time. I think we've kind of outlived the normal lifespan of a band at this point. Wilco's been around for 10 years. Not a lot of bands get to make records for 10 years, and not a lot of bands get to have their records become more popular as they get older and weirder, which is what is, you know, happened with Wilco. So I think that we feel very fortunate that things have turned out this way, and I guess just try and make every effort that we can to not take it for granted.
Jeff Tweedy of Wilco, which is apparently a family affair, his wife rolling her eyes at him there in the studio, and we know your young son Spencer played drums on one of the songs at a recent show.
I've been doing some solo touring, and my wife and my two boys have come out on the road with me a little bit, and when Spencer's allowed to stay up late and come to the shows, he sits in on I'm the Man Who Loves You.
We'll go out with that song from Kicking Television, but as we let you go, the title, Kicking Television, should it be, is it self-evident?
I do think television is a pretty damaging, prevalent part of our society that I think does very little good for anybody. But I also think that it's really fun to watch TV.
Jeff Tweedy, thanks so much.
Thank you. All right, off to the Lego store.
Oh, something really important.
All I see is black and white and white and pink, pitch blue. Between the words I paint on a pitch, all's me no sound. You can tell if they bring my heart the way I want it when I started writing a set to you. Yeah, I could, you know, I would just hold your hand if you understand.
And for more on Jeff Tweedy and Wilco, including their just-announced spring tour dates, check our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Jessica Gerard, Angela Kim. Thanks for your work today, Angela. And Daniel Estrin. Daniel, thanks to you, too. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin.